Welcome to episode 43 of Major Revisions. With me, as always, is John Walter from the University of Virginia. And not with us today, actually, is Grace. But instead, we have Dr. Atticus Stovall from the University of Virginia.
Hey, John.
Say hello to the people.
Hey, John.
Hey, John. Hey, people.
So we are actually sitting at the University of Tennessee Biology Field Station on the top of a mountain just north of Gatlinburg, Tennessee, where we have finished up about 2.25 days of field work, including LIDAR scans of, did anyone actually count the number of plots?
I think about 12.
12 sounds good.
Yeah.
12 plots. We shot for 13, but the 13th one wasn't going to work. But we got some extra ones that are going to be really good, too. So really excited about that. Also, this is a really nice place. This is one of my really nice little field station here.
Yeah, and so. Seems underused.
Yeah, definitely underused.
Yeah,
this place is
people
really
need
nice.
To stay here all the time.
Yeah, I would just move in here.
This is basically a mansion for $20 a day. That's that's how I live.
Yeah. A lot of props to the University of Tennessee.
Seriously.
Good school. Go Vols.
Vols.
Vols. They're the Volunteers, whatever.
Not the Bulls, man.
I mean, they're not literally... The sad part is that I lived very near here for many years and never really know. It's a weird color orange, too.
It's a little darker than creamsicle, but pretty close.
We're going to get hate mail from all the people who live in Knoxville. Like, it's not creamsicle orange, man. God.
It's darker, clearly.
Hey, I said it was a little darker.
So Atticus, tell the people about yourself. Or would you like us to do an introduction for you?
No. I can tell you stuff.
Okay, tell us.
So most of what I work on is centered around better understanding of forest structure, forest function, and I spent, you know, most of the time working on my PhD centering a lot of that work on using this new type of terrestrial LIDAR and trying to use it in kind of more realistic ways, not ideal settings, very unpleasant places to work, and trying to crack some of these difficult ecological questions that can't necessarily be answered in any other way unless you have millions of dollars to answer those questions and a whole lot of manual labor. So that's why it turns out.
Or can cut down trees.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's, you know, I think that's one of the things that it potentially overcomes is it allows you to not cut down trees and also get an idea of, say, how much carbon is in a tree.
Let's back up. What is terrestrial LIDAR?
All right, so terrestrial LIDAR is basically this relatively new version of this laser technology that gives you the relative distance from this laser scanner. And it does that millions of times and creates this amazing three-dimensional reconstruction of whatever you want, really. But if you put it in a forest, you get a really nice, detailed, three-dimensional reconstruction of the forest itself. And so... you can take that type of technology and use it to do all sorts of interesting things, measuring branch angle in the canopy. You can use it to measure leaf angle in the canopy, leaf angle distributions, the amount of biomass in a single tree or the amount of biomass in areas of the forest or the distribution of that biomass. These are all things that, you know, that I've been working on through my PhD and now my postdoc, just trying to kind of take this instrument and push it to its limits to better understand what's going on with forest carbon and the way that forests function.
So how, what got you interested in this? Like, how did you come back to this?
Well, as the story goes, my awesome advisor, Hank Sugart, he happened upon a little itty-bitty grant and decided to buy two laser scanners because he was like, it's the future. And so... and so I was starting out in grad school and, you know, I probably went into grad school with, a different idea of what to expect exactly. I started kind of on a master's path, ended up on a PhD path. And part of that was because Hank put these, you know, instruments in front of me and said, hey, you think you can do anything with them? And I'm like, I don't know, what do they do? He showed me some pictures, and they look like beautiful three-dimensional images of reality. And I said, whoa, we can do anything with this. I'm going to do that. The problem being, you got to figure out how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I spent all my time doing. And, you know, it was basically 2.5 years of, I don't know what's going on. Followed by, whoa, I figured one thing out.
To be fair, 2.5 years is good. That's,
yeah.
That's better than average, yeah. Probably.
Well, the thing I figured out wasn't very good. No.
Hey, and you had a new technology. You had a better excuse than I did anyway.
Yeah, we were working with old shit. And we, you know, it took us a while.
Yeah, but the old shit was broken, so... This thing was working. I, you know, you go out into the field, you hit a button. That's my field work. It's, yeah.
So we were talking about this earlier about the, so, to fill everyone in, we just spent the last 2.25 days. I say a quarter because we showed up here, I guess, on Thursday and went out and did one plot.
Yeah, quarters,
quarters may be generous.
A little generous.
Yeah.
But to be fair, we spent probably like 20 hours in the field in the last 2 days.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah,
that's,
you know,
fair. All in.
Yeah, it's a lot. You know, you go out to these plots and, you know, you take a measurement with a machine. Like you said, you're just hitting a button and it scans around and records all the data.
Deceptively easy.
Yeah, so that part's deceptively easy. What does, you know, after you get that data, like, what does that look like?
Yeah, so most of what happens afterwards is kind of a product of what you want to do with that data in the first place. So, you know, one of the things that we're working on here is this kind of idea of measuring the distribution and location of how many leaves are actually situated in the canopy. And so for that, you know, you have to, well, first of all, come up with a way to figure out how many leaves but really the thing is that the kind of like limiting step in all of this is that every time you hit that button, you're collecting upwards of, you know, 30 million data points. And, you know, in ecology, that's like absurd.
Yeah.
So as ecologists, and I'm like a wannabe or faux remote sensing scientist, that number is like pretty high, and how to manage that, you know, is a big issue. And so that can be a huge challenge as far as figuring out what to do with it. But after, you know, you figure out how to take all these three-dimensional points in space and translate them into how many leaves the area of leaves and where they are in the canopy, you can use that to, you know, reconstruct the structure of the forest canopy. And that tells you a whole lot about some other stuff that Jeff knows.
Hey, Jeff? No comment. It's all hypothetical. It's in theory.
You're the master.
But there's no
I read that paper.
So, I guess we should also talk about, like why we're here.
Yeah.
So I guess we mentioned we're at the University of Tennessee Field Station.
So if you, I scooted far away. I didn't mean to. I have a roller chair.
We have a carrying bonus.
Yeah, it's true. We also banter on this show, so it's fine if I can edit this out.
You're not going to.
So we're working at the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, which is about just shy of 600,000 acres. Straddles the border of North Carolina and Tennessee, follows the lower southern part of the Appalachian Mountains, Blue Ridge Mountains area here. And so while we're all here, actually, and, you know, we work with Atticus anyway, but we all came over here because we were funded to do some work looking specifically within the NEON plots, NEON being the National Ecological Observatory Network. They have a series of plots located along the western edge of the Great Smoky Mountains, here primarily in Tennessee. And so within these plots, we wrote a grant to basically just come out here and to scan these with LIDAR, yeah, and with the idea of, you know, measuring, you know, the variation in forest structure across the elevation gradient. Because, I mean, it's significant, right? Like, we were at the top of Clingman's Dome, which is like 6,600 feet, which I know there's going to be people out there who listen to this in the West who are going to be like, oh, those are tiny mountains. I just want to point out that your mountains are rocky and clear and easy to traverse, and you don't have rhododendron and mountain laurel and black flies and mosquitoes and budworms and everything else and spiders. What are those? The trapdoor spiders? Is that what they are?
Oh, yeah. The ones that, create the crazy.
Yeah. And so I've walked into literally 17 billion of those in the last 48 hours. And you don't have those, so I don't want to hear anything about that. Don't at me on Twitter about how your mountains are superior, because our mountains are serious, too, just in different ways. And we've also not seen a single freaking bear while we've been up here.
I wanted to see a bear.
I know. Yeah. I've actually just been throwing food randomly into the forest, trying to attract them.
Walking around with open lunch boxes.
Yeah,
it's key.
Yeah, I didn't really
open picnic baskets.
Yeah. Yes. Bears love picnic baskets. So we've been working, you know, across that for the last couple of days, and you know, John's expertise in community ecology and Atticus's in you know, terrestrial LIDAR, and I can carry heavy things, so it's been really helpful. You know, all of us in the last couple of days working on this project in particular, and we actually had good weather. I mean, all things considered, this has been like one of the most successful fieldwork expeditions. I didn't even want to talk about this till we were done, about how well everything was going.
Seriously, no, we're done. Yeah, it went well. I was here visiting some family, 4 days ago, basically?
Yeah.
And it rained every day, 3 times a day. So I guess all the water kind of just dumped out for us.
The rivers look great.
And yeah, I wanted to jump in. It looked great. So I'm very happy with how this went. It's especially good because most lasers don't like water.
And no, lasers hate water.
What was up with that?
You need green lasers, man.
You do.
But even
in that conversation,
if it rained on the laser, it would still like fry.
It's okay. It's green
in the middle of the woods. So, but like speaking of field experiences, Atticus, we would like you to tell the people more about, because you've traveled actually quite a bit in the process of either your postdoc or PhD and.
Yeah.
So everywhere from, like, was it Gabon and Africa to, you know, up to the northern part of Alaska.
Yeah. So I've had some kind of bizarre, ranging types of field experiences. Not all of them LIDAR related, but nonetheless interesting ecosystems to be in and fun trips mixed with just a little bit of anguish and pain. But I guess one of my first trips was to Indonesia, which was a really a really awesome trip to kind of. That was actually the first time I went to the tropics. That was for a workshop, but really the next time I went to the tropics, they were spaced basically these periods of time where I was doing these field campaigns. They were spaced by about a week, and one was in Costa Rica and the other was in Gabon in Africa, and so. That was a little bit challenging, partially because, it made me very tired. the Costa Rica work was another workshop working with this group Silvacarbon, and it was half training how to work with LIDAR and how to measure forests, and it was actually mostly a piece of cake. But the field work was, it's kind of like a nice crash course for me in field work in the tropics. But then the next week, I basically flew home to Virginia, and 4 days later, I left for Gabon, and it was 20 hours. You get there, and just pretty much everything about doing field work with a really expensive piece of equipment that is slightly threatening to like everyone is.
What do you mean?
Like, slightly threatening, as in you're walking around with a laser, and people just like look at you like, "What is that black case?"
Like Star Wars.
They open it up. Yeah, it's kind of like that's not a camera, clearly. I know you're not, so it's, just take, like, all the anxiety of moving through an airport and, like, add an item that is inherently suspicious and that can cause problems. But really that was nothing compared to the actual work itself. And once you get into Gabon, it's just figuring out how to actually get where you need to go with a large crew of people is a huge challenge. So we had about 15 people working in this field campaign, some from the US, some from the UK. We had some students from the university as well. And we basically all had to get in a boat and cruise across this enormously wide estuary in Gabon over to this national park called Pongara National Park, which is extremely dense mangrove stands, and they're actually the tallest mangrove stands that we know of in the world.
How tall are these?
So what they did is the year before they flew this aircraft over with LIDAR on it as well to estimate how tall the trees, the mangrove trees in this forest actually were. And they found stands of 60 meter mangroves, which is kind of just unheard of and doesn't make sense. Like in the US, like 20, 30 meters. So this is double anything normal that you might even consider. And so they're like, whoa, we got to go in there and figure out what is happening. Like, they have no preconceived notion about how much carbon would be in that type of system for mangroves, partially because mangroves are extremely dense wood, and the more dense the wood, the more carbon is actually mm-hmm. held in them above ground. So that's a huge thing that they're kind of like, whoa, well, we don't know much about the structure of these trees. We've never seen anything like this. We need to go and measure them. And that's why they ended up calling me, is partially because there's no real understanding of what a 60-meter tall mangrove tree has in terms of carbon. It's just like, what do you do with that?
That's 200 feet tall.
Yeah.
Just so you know, if you can't do the conversion in your head, that's 200 feet of big ass tree.
So one of the weird things about these trees is basically how they grow. They grow on prop roots. So it's basically like trees on stilts. So I have one picture of a guy who's working with us. He's trying to get the diameter of the tree. And usually you take the diameter of the tree after, you know, kind of like finishes its little flary thing towards the ground.
Like, so how big are the prop roots here? Like, how tall do they extend up?
Yeah, so that's kind of the challenge, is that this guy literally climbed the prop roots up to about, I don't know, he was 5 meters up, I'd say.
Whoa.
Roots go 5 meters up out of the water.
Yeah, and so he's about 5 meters up, and he's at that flared part of the tree.
Jesus.
And so we realized that this, like, very conventional measure of the diameter of trees, the breast height diameter, is just like, well, if you can't even hug the tree ever, that's a huge problem. But, you know, having some sort of laser that could do that for you kind of solves that problem. So we tried to do, you know, as many as we could in terms of the manual work, but really at the end of the day, like, some of these trees were just too massive to even climb. It just wasn't safe. We're like, no, don't do it. Just please don't measure the trees. Like, I can get up there. Nah, man. So, but really, like, to give you an idea of like what we were dealing with, every day, you know, we were staying in this national park in a village, and every day we woke up early in the morning, got breakfast, and got out on a boat. And there's a great guy, Carl, great guy. He would go ahead of us about 30 minutes, and he would scope out the plot. And if we found a good plot, we'd bring the 15 people in, and there'd be some flagging to tell us basically approximately where to go. And we would start trying to get into the mangrove. And the first real, issue that you run into is that we're going in low tide, which is very smart. The problem is you're dealing with roots that are submerged most of the time. And all the submerged roots are covered in these barnacles that are like razors. Like,
so you have tidal influence here at this point?
Yeah, yeah. So that within the estuary, you have a meter or something like that.
Jeez.
Wow.
Yeah. So everything that's normally submerged is covered basically in razors. So our strategy was like ram the boat like into the prop roots, hope that it would like kind of stick, we tie it off, and then you start kind of climbing them. And it's the best way I can describe, you know, this kind of field work, it's like climbing a flexible jungle gym in a way.
That's also covered in razors.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Razor jungle gym, because it's more fun that way.
Yeah.
But there'd be kind of this interesting pattern that would happen when you climb it, it'd be great, and you get up. You're not wet yet. You know, it's the beginning of the day. It's cool. You haven't fallen in. but But you know, you climb up the prop roots, these bangers, and it's basically, you know, a 12-foot jungle gym that you're kind of climbing around in. And we realized that the most efficient way to get around was just to get on the tops and try to kind of grab tree to tree. But inevitably, you know, about 30% of the roots are hollow because they've rotten, like, they've rotted out. And so 30% of the time you step on something that breaks, and then hopefully you catch yourself half the time. So 15% of the time you go straight down into mud that's either a foot or like 3 feet deep. And so then you're submerged in like the siltiest, slipperiest, like slimy mud that you could ever imagine. At which point you have to get back on the jungle gym covered in the slime and try to not fall again.
All of this while carrying a $40,000-$50,000 piece of equipment that's highly sensitive to sand, water, and basically anything outside, because it wasn't meant for that.
This is true. This is why, like, not trying to, you know, preach or advertise or anything, because these cases are obscenely heavy, but the Pelican case is really helpful because the scanner didn't break, basically.
Nice.
You know, setting that bar high.
It's okay. We've also, like, what is the other two products that we've, like, independently advertised? Like, OtterBox and...
Oh, yeah.
And LaCroix. But only
externally.
Only the Pufflemousse. Only the Pufflemousse.
That's the best one.
But apparently, like, the guy who runs that place has done some shady stuff, so maybe we want to revisit that, but anyway.
No.
Good bond.
I agree.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you know, there's only a little bit left to say about Gabon. Really, the last couple things would be we plan these plots to be about 100 meters minimum away from the rivers that kind of, you know, are going out into the estuary. And so, yeah, that's good because you want to buffer plots away from some of the exterior, like, influences and everything. The problem with that is that it took us about 2 hours to go 100 meters. So, yeah. So, you know, it's like this jungle gym madness for a real long time with 50 pounds on your back. And, yeah, it was a blast. It was real fun. The only other thing is, like, when you get into the plot, there are some interesting finds. One of them being, like, these cool ferns that are really beautiful and enormous, very tropical, but are kind of the native habitat for killer bees.
you have razor-bladed jungle gym trees that the roots extend 15 meters. And now you also have tidal influence, and now you have killer bees.
Yeah, I'm kind of questioning why I went there now. Like, I was like, cool, that'd be fun. So we luckily never got attacked by killer bees, but I can't even remember what the recommendation was. They're like, well, you can't run.
What do the bees nest in?
I don't know. Like, I mean, it's just those ferns are very, like, nice, sturdy objects to build a nest on, I think.
But I thought that they were kind of like a honeybee on steroids, and, like, honeybees...
Seems, yeah. Like, what are you doing?
I thought killer bees weren't a thing anymore.
Well, I don't know. Crazy stuff happens in Gabon, I guess, that I felt like the whole trip I was pretty much just a passenger, like, whoa, right. I hope I don't die. So,
I'm gonna Google this real quick. I'm just curious. I'm not doubting you.
No.
I'm just saying.
Hey.
I'm saying, are killer bees?
Look, this is a thing. This was a NASA recommendation. So, I mean, part of this was they did a little bit of field work the year before, and there was the bee issue, but then there's also this black fly or something that would was like endemic to the area that would give you a parasite.
Yeah.
That would like really mess you up for, the treatment took like 8 months.
Oh my god.
And the things it does to you, I don't want to say on here, but it's just super.
No, kids don't listen to that. What happens to you with this parasite?
I think it's just like your body just starts to really deteriorate because you have something living in you. But it lives in your blood, like there are worms in your blood in a way.
You get blood worms?
Yeah, it's super weird stuff. Like, you don't want that going to your heart. And anyway, so
I don't want blood worms.
So we were advised to bring, you know, bug nets and whatnot. But the last thing I'll say about Gabon is when you're lucky enough to finally get out of the mangrove. The kind of final challenge is like getting on the boat, because the mangroves are like, they're kind of like rubbery jungle gyms. You want to jump off them, but they don't want to let you do that in the razor blade thing. So, so I had this like 50-pound pack on me, and the first day we're out there, I'm thinking, all right, yeah. I was actually the first one in line to get out of these mangroves. That's what I knew. But I was like, all right, yeah. The problem was that it was really late in the day and the tide was coming in. The wind was picking up, and so waves were just starting to kind of pound the shoreline. And as those waves were pounding the shoreline, the real issue was, you know, that the boat could not actually come in long enough for us to get on it. And so it was kind of a real timing sensitive kind of maneuver. But then finally, you know, you gotta just go for it. And so I jumped for the boats with $40,000 of equipment on my back, and I definitely missed. It was like totally submerged. Like, I mean, you know, it was probably only like 8 feet of water. I don't think I hit the bottom. But luckily, again, Pelican cases. there was some flotation going on. But of course, I was like, I don't matter. Save the scanner. So I just like check the scanner under the boat. And we finally, everyone got back on the boat. You know, no one died. Yay. That was good. And we spent about an hour and a half getting back, in like kind of dusk and super choppy conditions. And so I was like sitting in front of the boat, which is like, right on the, yeah. So I was like bruised. My body was like bruised from that first day. For the rest of the, you know, 8 days of field work. And that was pretty much, yeah. Gabon was awesome. So it's kind of, I think it's good to have those types of experiences. Partially because it gives you a measuring stick. And
so like everything else just seems like a piece of cake.
Yeah, so you're just like, Smoky Mountains? Gatlinburg, yes! Like, this is gonna be a blast. So, you know, I can definitely see the value in having those experiences, even when they're tough. You know?
So when are you going back to Gabon?
Don't have any near-term plans. But, you know, I mean, the thing is, like, the really tall stands, I would probably go back to, because the extremely tall mangrove stands are beautiful and yeah. Just unlike anything you've ever seen. I don't even know what to compare them to, because they're just so stunning. Because the canopy is just so far away, and you don't see a lot of broadleaf canopies like that. Broadleaf, you know, trees that create that single layer. So it's like being in a cathedral. really. That's the thing about it.
Do we know what makes them so big? Like, are they just massively old?
Yeah, so one of the things is that area of the world, and those very specific areas of that mangrove forest are a little bit more sheltered from tropical storms that kind of occur around there. And on top of that, there's kind of this gradient from the most saline, salty part of the estuary to the more freshwater part, where you can see a rising canopy height. So it's like the more freshwater part of the estuary seems to have, like, support these larger mangrove forests as well.
And it's also probably more protected, too.
Exactly, yeah.
So,
yeah, so disturbance. That forest is, like, is very protected. And actually, when we were out there, I mean, one of the big things is illegal fishing, because the fishing is so good near the mangroves. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, when we were cruising around in our boat, we saw, like, 5 different boats stop for fishing illegally, but it's like, you know, it's a really amazing area, with just incredible ecology. It's like, that's what's up. Makes me stoked. So yeah, I definitely don't have anything against Gabon. It's, you know, if anything, it's me for wanting to go into the mangroves.
So I have a question for you. So obviously you were probably aware, like, there were going to be some things that were going to be challenging or different. But what was the thing or things that once you got there you didn't even really, that just kind of surprised you? The unknowns.
Yeah. So it was probably how we were going to get places ever. Was one of the big things, and just if we were going to survive, like, because, like, in general, I mean, I try to keep a pretty positive attitude, but that was one of the few times where I think I was like, well, here I am, I'm just going to kind of, like, commit to this field work, and, you know, I'll be careful, but I'll get what I need, but I should definitely be careful, because it didn't seem like there's a lot of safety net here. So, but for the getting places thing, it's just, you know, figuring out how to navigate a large crew of people in a country that doesn't necessarily have a standardized way of dealing with that. Is just that alone is a huge challenge. And I think that's probably, you know, something that a lot of people have experienced when they've tried to do some form of field work in,
yeah,
you know, in a country that is, it's not like driving somewhere
in Tennessee.
Yeah. It's like, hey man, you want to drive down to Tennessee and shoot some lasers?
Yeah. Yeah, man, let's do that.
And we love Tennessee, don't get me wrong.
Dude, we do, of course.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, look at us.
Yeah.
It's been sweet.
I didn't even tell you about the crazy millipedes.
What about the crazy millipedes?
I mean, there
we just can't tease that on the show. And people are going to be like, what about the crazy millipedes?
Yeah.
No. Six inches. Easy.
Wait, in Gabon or here?
Here.
Oh, yeah. I know they're here, but, like, what are they in Gabon?
Not
3 foot long?
In Gabon, easily a foot long.
What?
And 100% the size of a hot dog. I was, like, my only, you know, interesting millipede story is, you know, not long, but I was kind of, like, crouched, chilling, like, while the scanner was doing its thing on the top of the mangrove, you know, proper, and I'm just kind of zoning out, really enjoying where I was, because I wasn't going anywhere. I was in one place. It was really beautiful, You know, there are amazing birds calling out everywhere.
Just, no razor barnacles. You found a solid prop route.
I wasn't bleeding. Like, all the things. And I just, like, kind of looked down between my legs. And, like, out comes this massive, like, it was definitely that big.
This is an audio format. That's not helpful.
I'm asking you, Jeff.
He's holding his fingers approximately like 18 to 22 inches apart.
No, Jeff likes to exaggerate, but
it's a range. That's
my God, it was, so it just like, it crawled out right from under me, and I was like, nah, I'm good. this is enough data.
The killer bees didn't worry you, but the millipede.
I mean, they worried me, but I didn't interact with them. And then
the millipedes were a constant sense.
It was just, yeah, it was, I mean, and the only other really interesting creature that I saw were these crazy, like mud skipper things.
Bears?
But these mud skippers look like, I mean, they're pretty much what crawled out of the, you know, primordial soup. That's, they're like the most ancient ancestor. Like, cool, land is interesting. Let's try this out. And they were like iridescent and bizarre and absurdly large. I mean, they were like fish with hands. It was odd. Anyway.
This
was like, I feel like I'm taking this show in an odd direction. Anyway,
this show goes in an odd direction a lot of times. So you've also done work far extremes as well, like the other end. So you recently just went up to Tulik, which is
Alaska.
Not Nome, Alaska, but where in Alaska?
So it's pretty much it's about, I guess it was like 4 hours north of the Arctic Circle. So it's like,
jeez,
it's maybe 50 miles south of the Arctic Ocean.
Wow.
So it's kind of up there. It's definitely a tundra-y.
So how do you even get there?
So, getting there to Alaska was a challenge, but I won't go into that. But I mean, that's just itinerary issues. But as soon as you fly into Fairbanks, so you got to start in Fairbanks. There's another option, but it's not convenient.
There's Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau. That's pretty much your airport.
Yeah, and there's another. It's Prudhoe Bay, and it's like one flight a day.
Is it an airport in Prudhoe Bay?
Yeah, yeah.
Huh.
So that would be
the Arctic Ocean. You and like 20 Exxon executives.
Right? Exactly, yeah. So
is the plane like 90% first class and 10% coach?
And this is like a Gulfstream. Yeah. Just chilling in the bat, like on the wing.
Yeah.
But yeah, you get into Fairbanks, and Tulik has, you know, they have a pretty good system where they have kind of there and back NSF work truck, and you get into Fairbanks and you hop on the truck and, you know, go up the Dalton Highway. And so once you get into Fairbanks, you get on this truck, and the thing with the Dalton Highway, if you're not familiar with that name, it's basically the entire setting for ice road truckers.
Wait, they're on ice though. Is the Dalton Highway ice?
I mean, that would be in the winter.
Sweet. Sorry, it sounds awesome.
Better to drive in the winter.
Yeah, exactly. So the real problem is that there are sections of the road where they're like, yeah, let's pave it. That's cool. But then they forgot about what permafrost is and what does. So those just turn into a roller coaster that goes up and down every 10 feet. And so it's just like the dirt part of Dalton Highway is significantly better than the paved part. But really, yeah, it's pretty much a 10-hour drive on a really wide, unpaved, destroyed road. going, I believe the speed limit's 55.
Yeah. They have a speed limit?
Yeah.
Who's going to pull you over?
No one. Because no one goes there. And that's part of the, that's another, like, piece of the issue. The other piece is, like, if you, like, go into a ditch, which the likelihood is, like, I don't know, like 30%.
Oh, that's lower than I thought you were going to say.
I'm an optimistic guy. But if you, you know, if you careen into a ditch, no one's coming. Like,
wow.
But, you know, you can rely on the goodwill of people to help you out potentially. But really, you know, it's 10 hours of Washboard Road.
That sounds awesome.
It's awesome.
So what's the radio station like?
Oh, there aren't any of those.
Can you get
that's
CB radio?
XM.
Yeah.
CB,
so
CB.
So that's the thing. Like John brings up kind of the biggest part of your journey up the Dalton Highway is using your CB, partially because you don't want to die. So what we would do is, you know, we're in a smaller vehicle, just a truck, like a work truck, going up this road, and it's mostly these truckers. And so if you go around pretty much any corner where there's no visibility, you, like, get on your CB, you're like, northbound four-wheeler, and, like... Whoa. Coming around the bend, or something like that.
Quick time out. Do you have a CB handle? And was it, like, assigned to you, or did you just need to make one up?
I mean, that depends on if you get into a conversation with who you are. I remember this one dude named Dan. Great guy.
Dan, that's a terrible CB handle, though.
Right? Yeah, but I'm nerdy. Yeah. And,
Dan? Okay, come on, man.
But, not even, you know, really creative. Like, exactly what you would imagine, you know, driving up a really long, super isolated road, talking on a CB would be like, is exactly what it would be like.
Did you make friends with Feline Frank?
Not that guy, but my brother. Doggy Dan. No, but yeah, so, yeah, it's a pretty long drive. But yeah, that's part of the thing. But, you know, once you get up there, it's, I feel like I'm going to increase the traffic of Tulik right now, but it is, like, the coolest moon base of any Arctic field station. The food is incredible, first of all. They have, like, top-notch chefs up there. Literally, the day I left, I ate Eggs Benedict. What is happening? It was, like, the weirdest contrast of... I'm living in space with, what are these amenities?
Like, so what made it like a space station?
Well, it just, the isolation was really, you know, one of the key things that, you know, you get there and you haven't seen anything for 10 hours other than one gas station that's 6 hours in, and you're like, people! And I'm like, wow! And then you have the same feeling when you go the whole way, you finally get there. And, you know, it's just this, it's just like several kind of pod-like buildings connected together. And it's on a lake. It's the Tulik Field Station is named after the lake, Tulik Lake. It is just like the weirdest experience being so incredibly far north. You know, it's also the summer, so the sun is never setting, and just the whole experience was pretty crazy. I think one of the things that blew my mind most is, you know, I'm a forest ecologist, and I was in a place way above the tree line. So, the first question is why?
Why are you even there?
Yeah, so it was definitely not for forced ecology, but the postdoc that I'm working on right now, our project is focusing on kind of remote sensing, directly estimating rates of photosynthesis. And so we're putting together this network of sensors all over the United States that are looking at plants and relating that to some flux towers to try to estimate how much photosynthesis is basically happening in real time with light. So one of the things that I was very fascinated to learn, shortly before I started this postdoc, is that plants do this cool thing when they photosynthesize, where they give a little tiny itty bitty bit of light off during the process of photosynthesis, and the brightness of that light is directly proportional to how much photosynthesis is happening. So basically, plants are glowing all around us in a wavelength of light that we can't see, and the brightness of that glow tells you how much photosynthesis.
So how do you measure the brightness of that glow?
Well, so you use a form of spectroscopy, which is basically really high resolution look at the wavelengths of light that occur from the visible to the near infrared to the infrared. And there's a special little place where that wavelength of light is emitted that you look very closely at, and you use that tiny little bump in signal from what you would expect. So basically, if you looked at like a wall, a wall of vegetation, because a vegetation has a certain spectral signature, right? So you can, I don't know, if you took ecology and like, or a remote sensing class, you're like, what does grass look like? What's the spectra of grass? And basically, there's a big hump after the near infrared, where you have this big red edge.
So when you're talking about spectra, you're talking about, like, you imagine like what like the electromagnetic spectrum is, right? Like of like light reflecting from that product, and so like,
and what
green things
what
show
would
up
green
in green?
Things be?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Gotcha.
And so in the near infrared area, you have this big increase in that spectra. But there's what someone discovered, basically, was that there's this little area where it didn't do what you would expect. Mm-hmm. And this is like, I feel like the way a lot of this stuff usually goes, where someone says, why is this doing this thing that's weird?
Yeah, all the big discoveries in science are like, that's weird.
Weird. So this tiny little hump, they zoomed in on it and they started relating it to, maybe that's a wavelength of light that comes out during photosynthesis, and sure enough, it is. There are two areas where that happens, but you can take these little bumps and relate them to how much photosynthesis is happening. And that's basically what we're doing across the whole U.S. with these sensors that are set up at these flux tower sites that are also measuring how much carbon is going into an ecosystem and out of an ecosystem. And if you know that, you can get an idea of how much photosynthesis is happening. Relate that to the brightness of that light.
Yeah.
So if we relate those two things, we can know for sure that this like glowing plant signal that we're seeing is actually photosynthesis, and that would change everything about how we can measure global rates of photosynthesis.
So what's the fancy name for this?
Solar induced fluorescence.
Ooh.
SIF. So we call it SIF because You don't want to say a lot of words.
I hate saying a lot of words.
Yeah, so SIF is the acronym that we use.
So that's what brought you all the way to Tulip, was to work on the sensor, right?
Yeah, I had to do some work calibrating the sensor because that signal of light is so small. You have to do a very specific, careful calibration of this instrument so that you can actually detect the signal at all. Because it's so extremely small, it's in the 1% of the total signal range. So that's, really how I got into all of this is because I spent a lot of time during my PhD focusing on the structure of forests and like what does the structure in the forests actually tell us about which carbon is in a forest. And I spent so much time focusing on that and not necessarily focusing on real-time measures of function, like how a forest is functioning, that it really made me interested in that side of the functional signal of the forest in the kind of context of remote sensing. So in that way, it's kind of like the classic way that people match all the structure is indicative of the function in a certain type of system. So
yeah.
So it was kind of like that second stage for me that wasn't necessarily inherently built into my PhD work. So that's what brought me to Alaska. I had to calibrate this sensor. And, I felt pretty lucky as a forest ecologist to go to such a glorious place where, it's just like a rainbow of different colors of plants in this endless landscape of tundra. And, a day after I left there, I went to New Mexico. Do the exact same thing. So, from tundra to desert. So the whole, it's this postdoc is really just like this interesting tour of different ecosystems that would have never been a part of my life otherwise. So it was pretty cool opportunity to get to to go to these places.
So it kind of sounds like we're still in a stage where we're sort of calibrating this like relationship between photosynthesis and production as measured by SIF. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, totally. I mean, there's a lot of evidence and there's a lot of reason to think that this is very closely, like a close relationship. So the brighter that signal, the more primary productivity or photosynthesis you end up seeing. But there are a lot of complicated factors with using reflected light to tell you something. So one of the things that is a big question, and this relates to a lot of stuff that Jeff does, is thinking about how the distribution of leaves and a canopy relate to the productivity of a certain system. So in the forests here in the Smoky Mountains, you have an extremely complex forest that's many, many layers. And if we were to take one of these fluorescents instruments to estimate how much photosynthesis is happening in real time, well, would it be able to effectively tell us what that complexity of the canopy or the layering actually translates to in terms of the productivity of the ecosystem? And so that's one of the things is like figuring out how the structure of a system impacts this estimate of photosynthesis due to the kind of glowing light during the process.
How much of that is a uncertainty is a product of the principle itself or the instrument that you use to measure it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, really, it's, I mean, it is so new that really there's a big debate in the literature right now in terms of, is it the structure of the whole ecosystem that's driving the number? So basically, if you have more leaves, is that the only reason you see a higher signal?
Mm-hmm.
Because more of your signal is filled up with leaves? Or is it that you actually are seeing those rates of photosynthesis? So if you can't distinguish between the two, then kind of in a tough spot.
Yeah.
But if you kind of normalize by the amount of structure that you're looking at, you start to kind of solve that problem. And that's, in a way, where the expertise that I have come into work that I'm doing right now, because I know how to measure structure. Like, I've been doing this for a little while now, and I have a good idea of how I can take structural information about a forest and funnel that into these other estimates of productivity to maybe get a better idea of if it's the structure driving that signal or if it really is a signal from photosynthesis itself. So once we figure this out, though, we can start to develop relationships that allow us to get these really broad estimates, like global estimates of rates of photosynthesis. And there are a couple satellites that are either up or planning on going up that will be able to monitor the amount of photosynthesis that's happening, really pretty high temporal resolution, like high frequency, really getting at the change over time, and that allows you to look at all sorts of things, like, well, what's happening with climate change in terms of, is that depressing the productivity of certain systems or enhancing other systems?
Yeah. So can I ask another jerky question?
Sure. Please do. I love this.
All right. So there is like a positive relationship between structural complexity and productivity.
Yeah.
Is there like an emergent property of structural complexity that explains this, or is it basically just like you have a more complex forest and you have more packing of leaves, so you actually catch more of the incoming solar radiation?
Well, I mean, I guess the way that I think about it is kind of on the ladder. Partially because, I think of the way that trees grow as an optimization issue. Like, you put your leaves in places where the sunlight is.
Yeah.
And that makes you grow good.
I'm biased here. I have a huge investment in it being the latter.
Yeah.
And not the former, so.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it makes the most sense that plants, well, okay, here's a great example, is we try our hardest to grow plants on our porch, but we live in a forest. And so the plants that we grow end up leggy as hell. And plants have a way of reaching towards the light.
Yeah.
And that goes across lots of different scales of size. And so trees do the same thing. And if there's a gap in a canopy, you take advantage of that because that's a resource that can be utilized and make you a more productive organism. So, in a way, there's kind of an optimal amount of leaf area per individual that you can get relative to your like surrounding tree competitors that are also taking up sunlight. So, depending on where you are in the world, if the sun angle is low, or if the sun angle on average is right above you, that starts to shift the way that the plants grow because they're optimizing their growth form to what the sunlight basically is in that area. So that's part of the reason why I would lean towards the latter and also Jeff's stuff. Because I love Jeff, and
don't throw me into this, man. I don't,
no, I mean, I mean, it also makes sense. I think it makes a lot of sense that say you come up with a measure for complexity, in theory, you might come up with that measure, and it might have something to do with not only how many leaves you have per square meter, but the number of layers you actually have, or where they're situated, and you know these types of things that might be really important in determining how effective you are as a plant, and that is complexity in terms of, like, architectural complexity for a plant, and I think that in a lot of ways will drive. A lot of what we're curious about in terms of productivity and photosynthesis.
So are forests super organisms?
Oh god. No. I'm not going to answer that.
I got no. That's not a thing. So I have a good final question for you.
Alright.
What is the snack game like at the one gas station on the Dalton Highway to Alaska?
All right.
What's that like?
So,
like, we talking like combos?
No, not at all.
What's it like?
It's pretty much like the smallest town in North Carolina that I can think of.
Wait, but I can't imagine a gas station without combos. What the hell?
Like, guys? What's there?
Well, of course there are combos.
Oh, right.
That's not all. No,
our null model is combos. So like, there's going to be combos. But like, what's it like?
No, they had so you basically it's all wood, very nice.
Good.
Wooden exterior, very dusty. Everything up there is mega dusty. So if anyone's driving anywhere, you're just and you walk in and. They're, you know, one or two of the nicest people you've ever met sitting at the behind the counter, and they have mega overpriced fruit. Like
they have fruit?
Like $2 per banana or something.
It seems reasonable for Central.
Yeah, it's way up there. You're like, how far has this banana gone?
Yeah.
Banana.
And
fruit.
Yeah, and you know, off to the left is a sitting area, and right in front of you is where you might order your soup of the day. Like
they have taquitos.
Yeah, in theory, they should have started to be coming in, but not that bad.
Huh?
Yeah, easy peasy. No, it was great. You did say taquitos, right?
Taquitos.
Oh, taquitos. I think we're talking mosquitoes, because I was
we know Alaska has mosquitoes.
Yeah, not when I was there. I was lucky.
Yeah. Have you seen the footage of, I think it's actually from Tulik. Like, somebody's filming, the Micromet equipment. And, all these mosquitoes, flying in and out of the sensors. I remember, watching this summer, and being like, how do you even possibly measure anything? There's just a billion mosquitoes, flying in and out of everything.
Oh,
how is any of these measurements...
That's all of the pictures that she showed me Shi Yang is the my postdoc advisor, and all of the pictures that he showed me from last summer when he was there have swarms, like a large mosquito is always on the lens. It's very like
nice.
Like awesome Japanese monster movie style, like yeah, didn't have to deal with mosquitoes. But taquitos, I'm sure they were there somewhere. But really, the...
If Alaska is known for anything, it's taquitos.
It really is. Now, I mean, mostly, you know, it was like three pots of coffee, you can get some soup, and a lot of overpriced, I don't even know what, behind a glass case. Yeah, it was a whole lot of nothing.
They keep the fruit behind the glass in Alaska?
I believe so, yeah.
All right.
Huh.
Super fancy stuff. You guys, there's $2
fancy
bananas. So,
you gotta watch those, yeah.
That was in Coldfoot. Coldfoot is great. A great
aptly
place to do.
Place.
Come and go.
Coldfoot. Yeah,
gas.
I wanna, how much is gas a gallon? I'm just curious. Like
$5? Well, we follow the gas pipeline up. So I think they just
so gas would be like super, I want to like think like gas is super expensive because it's in the middle of nowhere, but also like,
I don't know.
They have abundant amounts of gas.
I didn't know
literally how they,
it's under pressure.
Diesel vehicles.
The gas is under pressure in the pipeline, so you don't even have to use a mouth siphon.
You can just use right out of gas. Just like cut that thing open.
Woo!
You got plenty of gas.
Right at home, baby. Oh my god.
Well, Atticus, thank you for joining us. We really appreciate you telling us about your field adventures and your science.
This was lovely.
It was good. Well, you're always welcome back. In fact, we actually have a 6-hour drive home tomorrow. Maybe we'll just go ahead and record episode 44 while we're driving from Tennessee back to Virginia.
There's a lot of good stuff to talk about between now and then. So.
Yeah, that's true. And
truck
we'll,
stops.
Truck
I
stops and Bojangles chicken biscuits.
Ooh, baby.
Oh,
come on now.
All right. So thank you for joining us for episode 43?
I think so.
43. That sounds good.
It's likely.
I forgot what it was. We've also been drinking moonshine this entire time. just so you know. But this is where I do the normal sign-off stuff. I'm trying to remember what it is. I usually have it written down.
We usually talk about where our podcast can be found.
That's right.
Yes.
Fortunately, editing, I can cut this out. So make sure you check out the podcast on Google Play, Stitcher, and iTunes or Apple Podcast, whatever we're calling it these days. And
the interwebs.
Anywhere on the interwebs, just on our website, majorrevisionsshow.com. Check us on Twitter at @major_revisions. Also the same on Instagram, where there's some pretty hot pictures going on. In fact, I'll post a picture of this right now. And you can also email us at majorrevisionsshow@gmail.com. And with that, thank you very much for listening. Pass it around. Mighty, mighty pleasing. Practice corn squeezing. White lightning.